America is uniquely religious. It makes perfect sense. A lot of immigrants came here to practice the religion. And we have freedom of religion enshrined in our Constitution. Even with the developed world secularizing, America is still unusually observant. We're also really religiously diverse, more so than most rich countries. There is only one state in the US where a majority of the population belongs to one sect, and it's the one we're going to be talking about today. Obviously, most people in the US are some flavor of Christian, who are more similar to each other than different. Then there are Jews. About 50% of the world's Jews are Americans. And there's lots of immigrants from other places with their own religions, but most of them are maybe second generation at best. There haven't really been large Muslim or Hindu communities in America that have existed for hundreds of years, like there are with Christians and Jews, but contrary to what right-wingers on Twitter will tell you, the Founding Fathers definitely considered that someday there would be, and explicitly expressed their support for them. Then there are the completely homegrown American religions, something else that's inherently American. Freedom of religion means freedom to start your own religion, and being a nation of immigrants means there are always millions of people feeling unsettled in a new and unfamiliar country, prime recruitment ground for some odd ideas. No wonder America is the world capital for new religious movements. A lot of these are based on Christianity to a degree, but the majority of Christians, regardless of denomination, would call them heretical, and its members may not call or associate themselves with the mainstream denominations like the Catholics, Protestants, or Orthodox. Examples would be like Christian Science, Jehovah's Witnesses, and the subject of today's video, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons. Like how I was saying earlier about how America is uniquely religious, Mormons are uniquely American. Seriously, if you're American, try explaining Mormonism to someone who's not American. I wasn't raised very religious, and the Christian sect I was most exposed to growing up was another uniquely American church, Quakerism, albeit not founded here. And when I was a kid, I ran into some Mormon missionaries and asked my dad later, are Mormons Christian or their own thing? And he said something along the lines of, well, son, that's complicated. They say they're Christian. Almost all Christians believe in something called the Trinity, where God is made up of three entities, God the Father, which is what you think of when someone says God, God the Son, which is Jesus, and the Holy Spirit, which is the Holy Spirit. And most Christians say you have to believe in exactly that to be a Christian. But the Mormons don't believe in the Trinity. They believe that God and Jesus were separate. And also, they have their own whole book separate from the Bible that's about how Jesus came to America after he died and preached to people here. Even though one of the biggest, most important parts of Christianity is that there's only one God, the Mormons think there are other ones. The Mormon God has a wife, sometimes multiple wives, depending on who you ask. Then they say there are other gods that you shouldn't worship, but do exist. They think that humans are baby gods, and once you die, if you were good, you get to be god of your own planet. They mostly live in Utah and its neighboring states, but they were founded by a guy in upstate New York who claimed he'd found some metal plates with ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics on them explaining the adventures of Jesus in America. They don't drink coffee, a big part of their appeal used to be that they would let men have multiple wives, and they wear full-body underwear where the men have an extra sleeve for their penis. It can be a fun thing to explain. I would totally recommend trying this with a non-American friend. I tried explaining Mormons to a bunch of South African kids I was teaching English to at one point. I wasn't very successful. For as weird as their beliefs are, I have such a soft spot for Mormons. Even though I've never lived anywhere near Utah, I happen to have way more ex-Mormon friends than you'd expect from random chance. Most of the ones I know left the church because they were queer, but none of them seem to hate Mormons qua Mormons. They'll say that they can't believe the mumbo-jumbo, but it's such a high-achieving, pro-social culture, and more Americans should build communities like the Mormons do. There's an inquisitive spirit in Mormonism, something of a cultural rather than explicitly religious exhortation to go forward and build something new, to question and investigate everything, except for whether Joseph Smith actually found those plates. I might put it down to the humans are gods in embryo doctrine. If it's taught to you from a young age that someday you and everyone you love may be literally gods, you start to think about things in a higher scope. Mormons feel like the last bastion of high modernist 19th century Prometheanism. Yes, we can turn this barren desert into our lush utopia. Yes, it'll be hard. Grab a shovel, Ephraim. The unofficial motto of the LDS Church ought to be, you can just do things. These days, whenever I run into Mormon missionaries, I tell them that I personally have no desire to become a Mormon, but you guys are a great culture, and I wish you the best of luck. Today's episode is about a fantastic example of the Mormons' you-can-just-do-things spirit, one that wasn't that successful but was worth the old college try. See, as you may know, the alphabet used by you and I was not originally designed to write English, and English has suffered for it. Why does Star Wars not rhyme? But I think most people's reaction to the thicket of exceptions that is English spelling is, that's the way it is. You can't change it, so memorize the exceptions and do your best. It took a different kind of mind to say, why does that have to be the way it is? And that mind belonged to Brigham Young. I'm your host, Tor Parsons. These are my co-hosts, Jollibee the Durian, Thimble the Doll, Sluds the Shoggoth, and not really a co-host, but a new accessory, my Mjolnir Hammer. And this is Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. Mormonism, like many religions, started back in the 1820s during the Second Great Awakening. Other sects I've talked about, like Khorishanity, Shakerism, and countless others, all either started or bloomed in upstate New York around this time. Over the course of his life, Joseph Smith offered a variety of accounts of his moment of epiphany, but the official one today places him in 1820 praying in the forest and having God and Jesus, separate corporeal beings, appear telling him all the churches are corrupted. A few years later, Smith claimed to be visited by the angel Moroni, who showed him the location of gold plates that contained another testament of Jesus Christ, which he later claimed to have transcribed into the Book of Mormon. Smith's group, originally called the Church of Christ, grew and was kicked out of several states for their unusual practices, most notably polygamy, gaining converts as they moved. They founded a settlement in southern Illinois, Nauvoo, that became the second biggest city in the state by the 1840s. Smith deliberately replicated the American political system in his leadership structure and openly dreamed of being president of the US, announcing a campaign in 1844 while serving as mayor of Nauvoo. Contrary to today's stereotype of the Mormons as a conservative bunch, Smith's platform was quite progressive for his times. His main issue was the abolition of slavery, and he also had an eerily 2020 activist vision of police and prisons, wanting to mostly abolish the criminal justice system and replace it with investment in social programs that he said would make crime obsolete. Smith was killed by a mob in Nauvoo in 1844, becoming the first presidential candidate to be assassinated. But without a clear successor, the church split into dozens of denominations, some much more mainstream and assimilationist, others even more out there than Smith's own teachings. I wasn't aware of this until recently, but the transition from the original Mormon church founded by Joseph Smith to the main Mormon church that exists today, led at the time by Brigham Young, who brought the Mormons to Utah, was very messy. A few months ago, in the Public Universal Friend episode, I talked about how every cult or cult-like movement needs a designated successor for it to survive after its founder is gone. I cited Brigham Young taking the reins from Joseph Smith as a clear example, but Smith didn't name a designated successor. Some who knew him said he intended his son, Joseph Smith III, to succeed him, but his son was 11 years old when Smith died. There was a major succession crisis, and even years after Smith's death, it wasn't yet clear that Young and his followers would end up being the most successful sect of the Latter-day Saints. Some of the other sects, founded by other successor claimants, still exist. When Joseph Smith III grew up, he ended up founding what he claimed was the true Mormon Church. It's called the Community of Christ. Today it's based in Missouri, with about 250,000 members worldwide, and it's not only much more similar to mainstream Christianity than the other Mormon sects, it's also remarkably liberal, allowing female clergy and gay marriage. But when someone says they're a Mormon, that usually means they belong to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the organization founded by Brigham Young, Unlike a lot of the other attempted successor sects, they kept all the weirdest and most controversial beliefs and practices, but despite that, they won out largely because Young was a good negotiator with the mainstream authorities. An executive order from Missouri Governor Lilburn Boggs had commanded the Mormons to be exterminated or driven from the state if necessary for the public peace. Because of the Mormons' polygamy, skirmishes with other frontier militias, and an alleged assassination attempt on the governor, as well as other controversies. It was Brigham Young who brokered a deal with Illinois' powerful Senator Stephen A. Douglas to stop the state violence against Mormons if they agreed to trek out to somewhere out west and leave everyone else alone. Most of the population of Nauvoo went with him. Carefully consulting the limited and contradictory maps of the western frontier, Young chose a swath of land along the Great Salt Lake, an area he thought no one else would want, but still wasn't completely inhospitable. The area now known as Utah was controlled by Mexico at the time, but war was brewing, Manifest Destiny was popular, and if the Mormons could stake a claim to Mexican territory on behalf of the US, thought Young, maybe they could get the legitimacy they craved for so long. Even though the Mormons were chewed up and spit out by America, they were still bound to it. The LDS Church, to my understanding, has a very providential view of the United States, and to be very honest, I don't know if Mormonism could have been started anywhere else on Earth. The Church views America in a way best described as a new promised land. Brandon, who co-wrote this script, said he once met a Mormon bishop who viewed the Mexican-American War as God's plan in action. The war provided Young with his golden opportunity to flex his negotiation skills for the Mormons' gain. In 1846, before the Mormons set out to Utah, Brigham Young sent Elder Jesse C. Little to Washington, D.C. to ask the government to help migrating Mormon pioneers by employing them to fortify and defend the West from the Mexicans. President James Polk would offer aid by permitting the pioneers to raise a battalion of a few hundred men who were to join Colonel Stephen W. Kearney, commander of the Army of the West, and fight for the United States in the Mexican War, forming the Mormon Battalion, the only explicitly religious battalion in American history to date. Each soldier was paid $42 for a year of service and was given guns and other equipment needed by the American government, too. America's up-and-coming religious battalion only saw combat once, against a herd of wild cattle that overran the wagon train and forced them to fire back, killing about a dozen bulls. Despite this, the Mormon Battalion, who disbanded after the war, was immensely useful to the war effort by establishing wagon trails across the West, not only helping army logistics at the time, but helping aid in future travel like the California Gold Rush. By 1847, Brigham Young and the Mormons were now on preferable but still not ideal terms with the American government. Helping snatch this territory from Mexico got them at least more goodwill in D.C. than they had before. Soon, President Millard Fillmore would designate Young as governor of the U.S. territory of Utah, but it's not going to get statehood as long as the Mormons still practice polygamy. That was the big sticking point. Activists of the time often railed against the, quote, twin evils of slavery and polygamy. But that's an issue to negotiate in the future. As it is, Utah has more immediate problems. It's very cut off from the rest of the nation. A large number of Mormons were poor farmers or non-English-speaking immigrants who were either semi-literate or illiterate in English. The church sent a lot of missionaries to Europe around this time. And Brigham Young began thinking, well, English is a hard language. He himself was a terrible speller. For instance, here's a random entry I found in Brigham Young's diary in which he seemingly goes through his D&D character stats, like the pages headlined Traits of B. Young in his character, and then consists of a list of virtues with a number assigned to each one. I'm genuinely not sure what's going on here, but we've got a great attachment, great spelled like cheese grater, self-esteem, spelled like meme, and even whole words I'm not certain about, like causality, bacality, and alimentativeness. He rounds out the list with his final virtue, language, for 13 points. Then he seems to change the subject, tallying up money, M-O-N-N-E-Y, to send for guns, gold. Get this man a new alphabet, stat. I used to be really stuck up about people who misspell stuff. I would actually get mad at bad spelling, and then I realized English is a fucked up language, and I don't fault you for not being able to remember all the irregularities. Why are the two O's in book, blood, and boot pronounced three different ways? There's like 10 different ways O-U-G-H can be pronounced. I think people should treat English orthography with the respect that these spelling rules deserve, which is none. Did you know that judgment isn't supposed to have an E in the middle? Did you know that it doesn't fucking matter and everyone will understand if you do spell it with an E? I don't let common misspellings bother me anymore. With One exception, my number one English language pet peeve that I won't let go of because I like having a little inconsequential thing to get mad at from time to time, people writing breath when they mean breathe. You will see this all over the place if you look for it. The air that I breath. Breath in, breath out. Breath is a noun. Breathe is a verb. They are differentiated by the E at the end of breathe, and everyone does understand that they're pronounced differently. I've never heard anyone mix up breath and breathe in spoken English. I stopped to catch my breath because I was running so fast I could barely breathe. Any fluent English speaker will be able to pronounce that correctly, so learn to spell them correctly. Breathe is pronounced breathe because it has an E on the end. There's a fucking E on the end. Anyway, so if you have a large population of illiterate pioneers and you have a mentality that you're starting civilization anew here in Utah, doesn't it make sense to simplify the English language? Luckily, linguistics wasn't a new field for the church. Joseph Smith also claimed to be endowed with a gift of translation. The gold plates that contained the Book of Mormon were allegedly written in a language called Reformed Egyptian that only Smith could translate, with a seer stone placed in his hat. There's other examples too, like the time Smith randomly bought some ancient Egyptian mummies and papyrus scrolls off a traveling salesman, and declared that, surprise, surprise, he had translated the hieroglyphs and found they made up a New Testament of the Book of Mormon. That's an entirely different rabbit hole that I might cover in a later episode. Look up the Pearl of Great Price. Even today, many Latter-day Saints are required to learn a foreign language because most young Mormon men do a mission trip as a rite of passage, and it's not uncommon to meet a missionary who's fluent in several languages. With all the demands of English, the notion that the Mormons had founded a new utopia on Earth where they were reinventing civilization from the ground up, and the church already having a history with linguistics, I suppose it's not that difficult to see the reasons for simplifying the Latin alphabet. Brigham Young commissioned his secretary George D. Watt, and a committee made up of the Board of Regents of the University of Deseret, now the University of Utah, to design a new phonetic alphabet. This would be the first alphabet designed specifically for English. Instead of being cobbled together out of a dozen different roots, you'd know exactly how a word is pronounced without needing a whole history lesson to explain how we got this word. No Mormon kids would be able to wow their parents by winning spelling bees. Where we're going, we don't need spelling bees. George D. Watt was the right man for the job. He was British and often cited as the first Mormon baptized in the UK, which he was, but only on a technicality. He'd been baptized alongside 8 other congregants and had won the right to go first by defeating them all in a foot race. More importantly, while back in merry old England, Watt had become fluent in a previous and much weirder phonetic alphabet, Pitman shorthand. Yes, the Mormons weren't the first to attempt to rewrite English phonetically, although they may have been the first to try to really replace the Roman alphabet. Pitman shorthand, and the other shorthand systems predating it, were created to solve a different problem. Most languages, complicated enough to have a complete writing system, are too complicated to write down quickly. Shorthands were invented primarily for courtroom transcriptions and recordings of important speeches and conversations in the days before tape recorders and voice memos. Secretaries, paralegals, journalists, all had to be trained in shorthand. And it really was its own language. This is the Lord's Prayer, written in Pitman. This is English. Shorthands didn't optimize for legibility. Most notes written in shorthand were planned to be temporary and rendered into plain English later. Of the many shorthands of the 19th century and before, the ancient Romans even had one they used in their courts, I don't think anyone seriously suggested ordinary scripts should be replaced with shorthand in our day-to-day lives. The only thing they optimized for was speed and compression of information. Pitman shorthand, the one George D. Watt learned, included a feature I don't know if any natural language has ever encoded meaning into. The thickness of a stroke determined the consonant sound used. Here's the alphabet in Pitman. Every stroke is a full syllable. The thickness of the stroke differentiates P from B, F from V, K from G, only that's not just a G, that's a gay. Pitman is based on syllables. A thick horizontal line with no other adornments is read in Pitman as gay. If you want to change that to game, that's this stroke. And if I want to change that to gamer, a word that I'm not sure has ever been written in Pitman shorthand, I add this hook here, because this hook means a final R. Pittman is cool and weird, but it takes at least as long to learn as a whole second language, and it isn't really practical for everyday use. Watt had to create an entirely new alphabet, one that, like Pittman, has no ambiguity and spelling is based on sound alone. And within 2 months, he'd created one, presenting his alphabet to the church leaders in January 1854. The alphabet designed by Watt had 38 letters, though some users later added a few additional ones. Say what you want about the Mormons, this is a beautiful script. To me, it looks somehow Egyptian, which is fitting, although it has no connection to the Reformed Egyptian script the Book of Mormon was written in, nor to actual Egyptian hieroglyphs. Going back to earlier, book would be this, and blood would be this. The two O's in book would get their own letter for their sound, while the two O's in blood get their own letter for their sound too. And wait, there's more. Ever been waiting for the snowplow to come? While you've been buried in your Utah ski resort for so long you've overthought the social construct that is language? Well now, because you're in Utah, you understand that the two O's can have different characters to represent them, and you won't have to embarrass yourself saying snowplow again. The name chosen for this language was the Deseret Alphabet. Deseret is a word used once in the Book of Mormon, in which it's said to be the word for honeybee, in the language of the Jaredite tribe. Brigham Young admired bees as a symbol of the Mormon work ethic, and when the Mormons arrived in Utah, they petitioned the federal government for a massive territory, covering most of today's American Southwest, which they wanted to call the State of Deseret. The feds, again, felt that they owed the Mormons a territory because they'd staked a claim to former parts of Mexico. Their religion was weird, but at least they weren't Mexicans. But they cut the planned territory of Deseret down to size and named it Utah instead, after a Native American tribe. DC didn't want the formation of a large, powerful Mormon theocracy in the West. They wanted non-Mormon pioneers to go settle in the same area and dilute the Mormons' voting power, so they didn't let them call it Deseret. First of all, Deseret is a word of Mormon origin, so they'd be acknowledging the Mormons' special claim to the territory, and second, Deseret sounds a lot like desert, which this whole area is. And if you want to encourage people to settle somewhere, maybe don't choose a name that reminds them it's a desert. Deseret is still in pretty common use today as a romantic, historic term for Utah in Mormon circles, and it's why there's a beehive on the state flag. The LDS Church's main newspaper is called the Deseret News. There's also the Deseret Power Railway, a unique, isolated little train line on the Utah-Colorado border that I might do an episode on someday. Anyway, lots of Mormon-related things are named Deseret. One interesting thing about the Deseret alphabet, and a detail that it shares with Pittman shorthand and any other purely phonetic writing system, is that spelling in Deseret still isn't totally standardized because different English speakers pronounce English differently. So if you read a text in the Deseret alphabet, you can tell the accent of the writer from how things are spelled. For example, here's a passage in the Book of Mormon that happens to touch on something that's been one of my favorite English language quirks for years. This word, underlined on screen, is wherefore. On the left is a key to the alphabet published in the same book. See what's interesting about it? One of the few Deseret letters that looks like the corresponding Latin letter is W, or wu, as it's known in Deseret. But the first letter here is an H. That's pronounced wherefore. Ever met someone who pronounces WH words with a wh? Growing up in Oregon, I did. My third grade teacher, John Benson, would make the class crack up every time he said what or where. Or check out one of the most iconic documents of Oregon history, the 1970 Exploding Whale video.
Whale, whale, whale. The whale, a typic gray whale. Whale.
Along with the way I say frontier, pronouncing WH as wh is one of the classic distinctive features of an old school Pacific Northwest accent. And it seems, in Utah, which makes sense because both places are heavily settled by New Englanders. If there's anyone else I can picture saying wh without also having a Southern accent, like that TV broadcaster, it's some old Boston Brahmin lawyer. Wh has largely died out in the Northwest. You'll only hear very old people say wh anymore. There's a separate population in the South that still pronounces WH as wh. If we all used the Deseret alphabet, regional linguistics would become a lot easier. Imagine browsing social media in Deseret, seeing someone spell a word in an unusual way and being like, that's an interesting accent. Where are you from? The best thing about the Deseret alphabet is that it had this letter, and the name of this letter was gay. I'm not making that up. The final thing I'll show to demonstrate the utility of the Deseret alphabet is something called the Rainbow Passage. It's a vocal exercise designed to move your face around and pronounce all phonetic sounds, or at least all the noteworthy ones, there's a few variations, in the English language. It has many uses, but the two most prominent are safety professionals testing the seal on a respirator, or trans people practicing for a better passing voice. Note how the Rainbow Passage in the Deseret alphabet shows every sound in the English language and how much unnecessary stuff we have in our Latin alphabet. Okay, so Brigham Young wanted the Mormons to have their own alphabet, but for seemingly non-religious purposes, or at least as non-religious as, say, the Cyrillic alphabet, the one that Russian is written in, which was created by Christian missionaries so Slavic people could read the Bible. In fact, lots of scripts across history have been created with the purpose of evangelizing the people who speak the language the script is for. So it's religious in that way. But did the Mormon elite really just want to make things easier on Mormon immigrants arriving in Utah from Europe? Or did they have their own reasons for creating their own alphabet? Again, all the official reasons given for why they needed the Deseret alphabet would make just as much sense almost anywhere in the history of the English-speaking world. English spelling has always been janky. There have always been immigrants struggling to learn it, and missionaries who wanted them to be able to read their holy book. Why did it fall on the Mormons, of all people, to be the ones who decided to rewrite English? Did they have another reason? One that fits alongside golden plates and plural wives and gods in embryo and the planet Kolob? Sort of. Brigham Young wrote in a letter that he planned the Deseret alphabet to be a precursor to reviving the, quote, Adamic language, the first language that Adam would have spoken in the Garden of Eden and used up until the Tower of Babel. Some Mormons say that Deseret is itself a word from the Adamic language. Young seems to have been believed that by having more characters, a character for every sound possible in English, Deseret would be closer to the Adamic language. Not sure what the thought process behind that was. I guess that means that Brigham Young would have thought that Chinese is the true Adamic language, but the idea of an Adamic language has existed in Jewish and Christian thought long before the days of the LDS Church. And besides, no attempt was ever made to create a whole new Mormon language. The whole point of Deseret script was to find a better way to write English. Or, what if the real motive was to separate Utah from the rest of America? Many people at the time, both inside and outside the LDS Church, speculated that this was the true purpose of the alphabet. If Mormons write everything in an unintelligible script, how will outsiders know what they're doing? If Utah reaches a point where all the street signs and newspapers and everything are in Deseret, will many non-Mormons want to move there? This was the talk of the town in mid-19th century America. Papers whispered that soon, Mormons would be forbidden from writing in the Latin script, because they'd made their own script for complete and total secrecy. The Deseret alphabet was written about as if it was a secret code only Mormons were taught, as if the Mormons weren't culty enough already. And surprisingly, some Mormons openly endorsed this idea as well. Yes, they said, we need our own alphabet to keep us segregated from the sinful outside world. The Deseret News printed an argument in favor of the script in 1868, in which they recommended children should be taught the Deseret script from a young age and never learn the Latin script, saying, quote, our own literature would be open to them, and though it might be limited, the minds of those who perused it would be more healthy and strong than if they had a wider range of reading of an inferior character. And yet, that really doesn't seem to have been the main reason. This one journalist may have had his vision for it, but all the books printed in Deseret include a key to teach it to people. The LDS Church sold guides to the alphabet by mail order for 15 cents for anyone who wanted one. It wasn't a secret. Some of Brigham Young's writings even suggest that he planned to teach the Deseret alphabet beyond the Mormon world, not necessarily as a tool of evangelism, though probably that too, but simply as a better alphabet that he hoped would make the Latin script a thing of the past. It really does seem to have just been an example of the Mormons' pioneer mentality, that if the English language is broken, why don't we fix it? That you and I can just do things. Once the alphabet was fully finished in 1854, several things in the Utah Territory made use of it. Two school books were handed out to Salt Lake City area schools, although not every school in the territory got copies. The Deseret News printed one article a day in Deseret, with plans to eventually use it for the entire paper. It was found occasionally on street signs, and in 1860 a $5 gold coin was minted with Holiness to the Lord in Deseret. With such a new and efficient alphabet, the only way left is up, right? Turn on the subtitles right now. give them a good long look. Are they in the Deseret alphabet? No? Well then, what happened? As most things do, it came down to money. There were already tons of books in English, and reprinting every school's material in the Deseret alphabet was prohibitively expensive. Printing presses had to be built with entirely new metal type, designed for a language nobody had ever seen. And a printing press is a big, expensive beast even today. And like I said earlier, learning English is hard, but it's still possible. People learned it all the time back then, just like they do now. And for all those who could already read the Latin alphabet, how much more efficient is the Deseret alphabet, really? Its own creator, George Watt, disavowed the script pretty early on, writing this letter to Brigham Young in 1854. Dear Bro. Already off to a damn good start. I love getting a handwritten letter that starts Dear Bro. If you can mail me a letter that begins Dear Bro and continues in that style, you get a free Tours Cabinet merch item of your choice. Anyway, Dear Bro. I herein submit for your examination the result of much thought and extensive practice on the new alphabet since the Board of Regents last met. I candidly confess that I never did like the present construction of the alphabet. I am now thoroughly convinced that it is not the most expeditious method of writing and printing, but on the contrary, it retards the hand in its onward course. He had not given up on the idea of rewriting English, but he didn't like the alphabet as he'd designed it. He blamed intervention from others for its issues. The letter included some notes on how Watt wanted to change the script, but not enough detail to put the changes into practice. Brigham Young seems to have ignored Watt, which may be why Watt, later in life, joined a breakaway sect of the LDS Church and was never on good terms with the Mormon mainstream from there on out. A few people added their own idiosyncratic letters to the alphabet to fill what they thought were sounds they needed, but no serious changes were ever made to the script, and by the mid-1860s, the occasional newspaper column or schoolbook in Deseret had long since gone out of print. The alphabet had practically died out in use by 1869, with the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad, bringing travel and trade and, crucially, non-Mormon settlers to Utah. With the Mormons not being so far removed from the rest of America, a new alphabet didn't appear as alluring. Deseret script had a brief afterlife as a dingbat font, like Wingdings. You know Wingdings, that font that's all just symbols instead of language? That's a dingbat font. The symbols in Wingdings are called dingbats. I think that a lot of people assume Wingdings is just an Easter egg kind of thing that's there for fun, but dingbat fonts have a purpose, to add decorative features to documents. The border on an award certificate, beats separating chapters in a novel, etc. Those are dingbats. Before you had Canva, you could make your documents classier with dingbats. Because there are still a few printing presses in Utah with Deseret alphabet type, these were used as dingbats. Here's a voter pamphlet for a mayoral election in Salt Lake City in 1876 that uses Deseret letters as a border. Those letters don't mean anything. Over in England, Sir Isaac Pitman of Pitman Shorthand fame also got into the rewriting English business at right about the same time the Mormons were. In fact, I actually understated Pitman's contribution to the Deseret alphabet. While again, he never advocated replacing the Latin script with Pitman shorthand, he did create an alternate script that he did want to be put to everyday use, the phonotypic alphabet. This one could have caught on, I think, because it doesn't require a lot of brand new letters. Pitman tried to make his reform alphabet legible to those who already speak English, and it is. Here's a transition reader to get you used to it. All new readers of this book are supposed to understand phonetic reading. You know what this reminds me of? The fucking Lolcats Bible. Check it out. Here's Pitman's first phonetic reader. Roderick Heffley would be so happy in the universe where this caught on. I bet loaded diaper is actually the correct spelling in Pitman's alphabet. Also, do you notice something about the letters Pitman did add? They look a lot like Deseret letters. This isn't a coincidence. While Pitman wasn't a Mormon, and may have died having never heard of the Deseret alphabet, Mormon leaders were originally planning to adopt Pitman's spelling reforms as their official alphabet, rather than creating a new one from whole cloth. The Quorum of the Twelve Apostles, the church's main leadership structure, held days of debates about this and were ready to cast a vote to encourage teaching the Pitman system. Then, Willard Richards, the second counselor to Brigham Young, arrived on the day of the vote, coming back after missing the debates when he was sick. He saw the Pitman script and unloaded on the rest of the quorum. This was ridiculous. Nobody would take Mormons seriously if they wrote in baby talk like this, and instead he recommended, quote, "Throw away all characters that bear much resemblance to the English characters and introduce an alphabet that is original." The quorum was cowed and decided to consider Richard's proposal. If he'd been sick for one day longer, Young and Watt would probably never have created the Deseret script, and instead, Utah would have adopted Pittman's spelling reforms as their alphabet, an alternate English that sacrifices looking cool for being much easier to teach. Unlike the Deseret script, if Pittman spelling had been taught to Utahns, it might have caught on, and to this day, people would insist My Immortal must have been written by a Mormon. Or we'd all be using it. But probably not, because Mormons weren't the only ones to consider using Pittman's alphabet, and it didn't catch on anywhere else either. There were many other attempts at rewriting English at the time. Ultimately, that's the best way to understand the Deseret script, not as an example of the Mormons' you can just do things mentality, but the 19th century's you can just do things mentality. Pittman spellings were taught to illiterate prisoners in Victorian Britain and as the standard means of spelling in two American school districts in the 1850s, in Waltham, Massachusetts, and Syracuse, New York. It seemed to be quite successful and genuinely easier to learn, but it didn't have the long-term staying power of the King's English. It's hard to change something people are so used to. Attempts at spelling reform continued, although the story of the Deseret script turned off most people from trying to create a whole new alphabet. One who wasn't deterred was the legendary Irish playwright George Bernard Shaw. A lifelong critic of English spelling, when Shaw died in 1950, his will set aside his fortune to be put toward the creation and promotion of a better English alphabet. The person he had in mind to do this was James Pittman, grandson of Isaac. But the will money ended up going to an old friend of his, named Ronald Kingsley Reed, and the aptly named Reed came up with this script, 48 letters, each of which, like Deseret, only corresponds to a single sound. Also like the Deseret alphabet, it's very cool looking, and I wish it had been successful for that reason alone, but nobody had a reason to use it. Both this and the Deseret alphabet look like alphabets that suit the time and place in which they were created. The Deseret alphabet looks mystical and esoteric and suggests both ancient Egypt and the American West. This looks sleek and retro-futuristic, perfect for the space age 50s. Though Shaw had no personal role in his creation, of course, he died before getting to see any of it, it's known as the Shavian alphabet, in his honor. Realistic attempts to rewrite English ever since have been very timid and careful. Andrew Carnegie promoted a list of 300 words he wanted respelled in the early 20th century, which included reforms like replacing the ED past tense with T. Teddy Roosevelt supported the reforms, but the public laughed. It was a brazen attempt, but to my surprise, some of Carnegie's reforms stuck. He advised that words like brazen and surprise be written with a Z. Brazen with a Z caught on, to the point that I didn't know until now that it used to be spelled with an S, but surprise kept its S. Australian linguist Harry Lindgren proposed a change he called Spelling Reform 1 in the 60s, which was deliberately small in scope in the hope it would catch on. All it did was replace every use of the eh sound with a single E. Spelling Reform 1 was taught in a couple Australian schools for a few years, then was forgotten, like the rest of them.
Like the rest of them.
Like the rest of them.
The 19th and 20th centuries were actually littered with attempted spelling reforms, some of which we don't know much about. My business manager Jim, in his collection of old rare books, has this one from the 1930s called The Sociology of Invention that not only spells though as T-H-O, which is one of the reforms Carnegie promoted, but also spells thought, like thought! I love this, our standardizing habits in thought and industry. This reminds me a little bit of the Chicago Tribune spelling reform, where they just decided, also in the 1930s, to start spelling some things in a simpler way, in one of the country's biggest newspapers. Words they simplified were thorough, island, freight, bureaucrat, rhyme, telegraph, and others. About 80 words total. This continued as a quirk of the Tribune all the way until the 70s. Nobody else picked up the spellings. My co-writer Brandon and I both asked several Mormons or ex-Mormons we know if they had heard of the Deseret alphabet, and none of them had. We obviously didn't ask every single Mormon, but it's not really a well-known thing, inside or outside the church. But in recent years, it's found its place as a sort of curiosity. Several reprints of the Primers and Book of Mormon have been made as well, and a man named John Jenkins even translated the other LDS scriptures, Doctrine and Covenants and the Pearl of Great Price, into the Deseret alphabet too. I first learned about it because this bar in the Salt Lake City airport had its name written in the Deseret alphabet, just for fun. And something that's bound to interest at least one viewer is Jenkins' desperate republishing of classic works like Alice in Wonderland, Pride and Prejudice, and The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. You can even go online and download a browser extension that lets you type in a dead phonetic alphabet. Just for fun, Desperate was added to Unicode in 2002, one of the first scripts added to Unicode that isn't in common use anywhere today. I put a link to a Desperate Alphabet Translator down in the description, and here's some phrases you can translate if that's your thing. Comment below what they say. LDS presidents are regarded as prophets and believed to speak directly for God. Much of what Brigham Young said is regarded as sacred, to the point that he may have been at least as important, if not more important, in Mormon history than Joseph Smith himself. But the Deseret Alphabet wasn't a prophecy from God, just something he thought could help poor immigrants and their children read, which, regardless of what you think about Mormonism, I find to be a noble cause. New religious movements can die out quickly without a strong successor, and as Mormonism showed, the successor doesn't necessarily need to be handpicked by the founder. They just have to be strong-willed enough to take the reins and willing to speak in the exact same register that the followers expect the founder to speak in. If semi-contemporary people like the Public Universal Friend or Cyrus Teed had had a Brigham Young, who knows? You'd have a pair of missionaries knocking on your door telling you about non-binary Quakers or Hollow Earth communism. But the literature they hand out would probably be in the same letters with the same spellings you know and hate.